From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we'll talk with one of the people who shaped NPR and its signature show, All Things Considered, about the formative days of the network.
Later, how a Midwestern teenager's obsession with the golden age of Hollywood turned into a book 40 years later.
So here we were, literally June of 1978. We made this first sojourn via St. Paul to Los Angeles to interview the screen legends Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly.
And an engineer from Trek Bikes talks about weighing how a bike works with how it looks.
It can be 2 degrees of difference. That makes all the change in how the bike functions. And there could be something that you really want to do from an artistic standpoint, but if it hurts the ride, you have to find that compromise on something that actually functions and looks amazing.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The Public Broadcasting Act of 1967 paved the way for the creation of National Public Radio, which formally began on February 26, 1970. NPR has come a long way since its earliest days, moving from a time when it was seen as an alternative and experimental to the point today where it boasts the most listened to morning radio show in the United States.
Bill Siemering knows the early days well. The Wisconsin native was one of the guiding forces behind National Public Radio, serving on its founding board, and he later helped develop signature shows such as All Things Considered and Fresh Air. After decades in public radio, he shifted his focus to radio in the developing world, earning a MacArthur Fellowship in his efforts. Siemering was in Milwaukee not long ago, and he joined us in the studio to share some radio history. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure to be with you, Mitch.
Why was radio first important to you?
It was first important to me as a first grader going to a two-room country school outside of Madison, Wisconsin, and listening to the Wisconsin School of the Air. So I learned science, social studies, nature studies, music, art, all by radio. From that time on, I've been fascinated by radio.
Do you still have the memory of those voices coming through the radio from?
I do. Yeah. I do. And interestingly enough, the teacher would always have a manual and know what science things she had to have set up, or art things. So a number of them were women, which I realized later was not common in broadcasting. It was a wonderful way to enrich the education in a country school.
Right. The country school never would have had access to all these kinds of lessons otherwise.
Exactly. I mean, the teacher was teaching 3 grades. Which is enough.
Well, how did that work? At a certain time during the day, the teacher would just turn on the radio.
Right. Twice a day, she'd turn it on, and she knew what was coming. And we would listen attentively and do whatever we were told to do.
So when you think about that time and how radio shaped you as a first grader, what of that time still shapes the way you see how radio meets its listeners today?
Well, simply put, I guess every time I turn on public radio, I learn something new. And I always think of radio as a source of information and of extraordinary intimacy at times. It's the most intimate medium, really, because it's the human voice. And people are free to engage with a host and open up in ways that they wouldn't in any other way. Television is not conducive to that with the lights and cameras and everything going on. So radio and the listeners are creating the images. Listeners are imagining what you and I look like now. And it's nothing like what we do look like, of course.
Well, and it's funny, even today, for as long as I've been in radio, and I imagine maybe the same for you, I still, to this day, get the images wrong in my head.
Uh-huh. Right. But I think that's part of the ownership the listener has with us, that they're imagining this.
And it goes without saying that we are both tall and very handsome. So there was obviously a little bit of time between first grade and the early days of NPR. What was your connection to radio between that point and the point that you arrived in Washington?
So I worked at I worked my way through the University of Wisconsin in Madison at WHA, at Wisconsin Public Radio. First as an engineer, editing tape and so on, and then on air as an announcer, interviewer, reporter, that kind of thing. And then I was in the Army. I taught school up in Eagle River, Wisconsin, and I was teaching school and working summers at WHA. And they got a call from somebody I'd had as a professor at Wisconsin that wanted somebody that had experience in radio and student personnel. And I happened to have that combination because radio at SUNY Buffalo was a club, a student club. It was off the air in the summers. They'd go on the air 5 in the afternoon. And so it wasn't a proper station. Anyway, I took that opportunity because it was a wonderful chance to develop something. He gave me a lot of freedom, not much money, but we had a lot of freedom to experiment. And that's the way I used that station.
You created it. This is the station where you created This Is Radio, is that right?
Yes, which became Fresh Air. we established a storefront studio in the heart of the black community. This was during the 60s, and I was very keenly aware of the need for hearing from voices that aren't heard on radio. And so that all informed me in writing the mission statement for NPR that emphasizes the importance of celebrating difference and treating people with positive regard and to talk with many voices and many accents, because that's what America's about. And I wrote that because I was trying to make the transition from educational radio to public. And the words mean something. And by public, that means everybody. And so I was trying to differentiate it from commercial radio, from educational radio, from PBS that was already on the air, and to capitalize on the unique strengths of radio as a medium, and to reflect the issues of the day, if you will.
Well, and it's interesting. We're having this conversation in 2018. I would imagine that in the mid-late 60s, there were still plenty of people already at that point who were saying the days of radio are numbered.
Yes, yes. They were. And people would say, "Oh, you work in just radio?" I mean, people never say that to a print journalist. "Oh, you're just print?" I remember there was some public broadcasting event. There were television people and radio, and it was before we were on air with NPR. And the TV guys were going through some clippings from the New York Times. "So, Seymour, what do you think the New York Times is going to say about you next in a year from now?" I said, "We're not programming for the New York Times." I was being a bit smart aleck about it, but I was, you know, I mean, we have just a very different orientation.
Well, and the irony is that today the New York Times is producing audio programs.
Exactly. Because this is the age of audio. When the New York Times does that, and when the New Yorker, which is kind of the preeminent print publication we think of, as the New Yorker Radio Hour, we know that radio is now, you know, elevated to a wonderful place.
Well, and I've noticed this phenomenon that I'm curious to have you reflect on, because I think this is kind of what we're talking about. I mean, we're in this kind of podcast-intensive media universe today, and, you know, there are some really good ones out there, and there are some nightmarishly bad ones, and plenty in between. But I can't help but think when I listen to them that this feels a lot like an earlier time in radio, that people are wanting to make them for the same reasons that you and I got into radio, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Right, and it's this wonderful storytelling. And with the volume of news that we have to deal with, and you're dealing with, there's not the place for these more quiet, reflective conversations.
Where does your work in developing nations come in? What do you see as the relative importance of radio and audio in those places compared to, you know, what we kind of have the luxury of using audio for here?
Yes. So I'd worked, after I'd been working in public radio, I worked with the Open Society Foundation for 10 years, and they worked in Eastern Europe and Africa and Mongolia. The idea there, behind their work, was, look, these people have not had democracy for 70 years. They need, like, a Marshall Plan. And so George Soros set up foundations all over in these countries to talk about constitutions, media, law, and health, education, the basics, you know. So that's how I started my work overseas. And I went to South Africa first in 1993. This was a year before the elections, because I met with people that were interested in reforming the state broadcasting, South African Broadcasting Corporation, which was like a BBC.
Right. But at that point, it was probably just a mouthpiece for the government.
Right. And so they wanted to reform that so people could be informed about the election. And there were others interested in community radio. And interestingly enough, when the government formed their licensing authority, they only licensed community stations because they thought in the first year, because they thought they would best serve the interests of democracy, because they speak in local languages. And sometimes stations broadcast in three or more local languages. And they reflect the issues and concerns of the people, just as you do this here in Milwaukee. You're out in the community talking to people, finding out what their needs are and interests are.
How far along on the continuum were they in being able to do that?
Well, it's in terms of the production and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what we provide, in some cases, we usually always are working now with existing stations. One of our African trainers, Martha Zulu, begins her workshops by saying, "Why are we here to focus?" And it's a wonderful question. I also hear that is, why are we here on Earth? What's the purpose? What's the meaning of life? But it helps focus a station. Like, you know, are we just here to play our favorite music, or do we have a more serious purpose? So we now enrich their programming on climate change, on youth health, women's health, things like this. And we do this by always having African trainers. So we work with existing stations. We bring them together. We'll have experts talking about climate change in that country or a health issue. We give them a digital recorder and mic, and they go out and have a field exercise and then critique it so they polish their skills. Then we send them weekly bulletins on a topic, like how do you store water for drought or on malaria youth-friendly health services. And they, again, these come from there. It has the problem statement on one side and solutions and production tips on the other. So they can go out with little experience and do these.
When you do something like that, do you get a different sense of professional or self-satisfaction in what you're able to do versus, you know, shaping the various shows that you shaped in this country?
Yeah, it is. It's wonderful to see them take the initiative. It's a very different relationship. I just go over there on the first workshop sometimes. I've got a colleague that does the implementation and so on. But we have excellent African trainers, and they then go and mentor. They visit each station and mentor. But it's so satisfying to see the results, where you change attitudes about talking about safe sex, for example. It's wonderful to see that impact of radio on people's lives.
No one there is saying, oh, you're just in radio.
No.
Is there a similar spirit in that kind of work when you experience a station at that stage to what the spirit was like in those kind of formative years for public radio?
There is some parallel to that. It's such a different environment, though. But they're using this wonderful, imaginative, creative medium. I mean, they produce little radio plays. I mean, no one's taught them that, but they do that with sound effects and everything. And that's what's so encouraging to see them taking this idea and making it their own.
When you think about where public radio was in the late 60s, mm-hmm. early 70s, and you're developing, you know, All Things Considered mm-hmm. in 1971, when you look at the soul of NPR from those days, what parts of that soul are most still in evidence in 2018? I mean, the building obviously looks mm-hmm. a lot different.
Yes. I think it really reflects some of those core values. I mean, that we had in, because I think this is what you do with Lake Effect. The editorial attitude would be that of inquiry, curiosity, concern for the quality of life, critical, problem-solving, and life-loving. So I think that's what you do with Lake Effect.
Life-loving is an underrated part of the equation, too.
Yeah. Then I said, philosophically, time is measured by the intensity of experience. Waiting for a bus and walking through an art gallery may occupy the same time duration, but not the same time experience. Listeners should feel that the time spent with NPR was among their most rewarding in media contact. National Public Radio will not regard its audience as a market or in terms of its disposable income, but as curious, complex individuals who are looking for some understanding, meaning, and joy in the human experience.
Do you remember your surroundings when you wrote those words?
I wrote that on my dining room table in Buffalo, New York. But I'd been thinking about these things for a long time and trying to make the case for radio. As we began talking about how radio was called the hidden medium, there was some folks in television tried to keep radio out of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting because we were such an embarrassment, they thought. And, of course, we take money away from television, which is more important. So this was aspirational, but I thought it was also practical. So it was a wonderful opportunity. Now, a lot of stations, I think, thought we're going to be like the big guys. It's going to sound like CBS and NBC, and it didn't. So there was the first meeting of the public radio managers, I think it was about 2 weeks after we were live. And it was kind of a hostile crowd, I must say. They said, who are these people? They wanted to sound like, you know, so we have a conversational style, you know.
They wanted to sound like Douglas Edwards.
Exactly. Right. They were very suspicious of, we were using music in the program. We had arts features, of course, because we were considering all things.
Well, just calling it All Things Considered had to have been a radical change from the kinds of names that other news programs had,
right.
You know, the CBS Evening News.
Right, right. You know, and it was hard. I mean, there were some programs where, you know, there'd be a brilliant piece and something, gosh, awful that we'd be embarrassed about because we had a very small staff gathered together, some more experience than others. It took a while to gel as a unit. It was in beta form for a while. However, a program that was aired in October of 1972 won a Peabody Award, so we did get it together.
Well, and it is something when a document that you wrote at your dining room table in Buffalo, New York in 1970 still holds the same relevance and importance that it did 48 years ago.
Yeah, right.
Well, Bill Siemering, it has been a real honor and a delight to chat with you. Thank you so much.
I've enjoyed being with you, Mitch, very much.
Wisconsin native Bill Siemering was on the founding board of National Public Radio. He worked at NPR, WBFO in Buffalo, Minnesota Public Radio, and WHYY in Philadelphia. Today, he's a senior fellow with the Wincote Foundation, also in Philadelphia.
A quick break now, and then we'll chat with Dave Fandel about his four-decade quest to interview the screen legends of Hollywood's golden age. Lake Effect's history program returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The golden age of Hollywood ran from 1929, when the talkies were introduced, to the 1960s. Film stars were groomed and promoted by a studio system that could be both supportive and exploitive. When the studios began to break up in the 1960s, many of the stars they made famous were entering their old age. Some were still working by the late 70s, others were, happily or not, retired. But they were still accessible to fans in a way that today's celebrities are not.
And that's where our next guest comes in. For the past four decades, Dave Fantel has been asking for and getting interviews with some of Hollywood's best-loved stars. And those interviews have finally been published in a book called Hollywood Heyday, 75 Candid Interviews with Golden Age Legends. Lake Effect's Bonnie North caught up with him recently and talked about his love for the subject.
Dave Fantel, it's great to see you.
Good to see you, Bonnie.
And normally I'm seeing you in a very different context, but in this case, it's about something you're doing and have done for 40 years.
It's my avocation and not my vocation, because you're right. My day job, I'm chief marketing officer for UPAF, United Performing Arts Fund. But for the past 40 plus years, my outside passion has been the golden age of Hollywood.
Well, and you started as a teenager in the Twin Cities, somehow deciding that it was perfectly cool to write to all of these famous people and say, hey, we'd like to interview you. Now, this is done with a friend.
Yes.
And somehow they said yes.
Pretty astonishing when you think about it today, right? So, and I tell audiences, and they're just can't believe it. When we saw That's Entertainment very briefly in 1974, the compilation of all the great MGM movie musicals, we were 15 years old, living in St. Paul, and we became sort of hooked on the classics. So here we were about to graduate high school in 1978, and as you said, my friend and co-writer Tom Johnson and I said, you know, many stars of the golden age are in their golden years, but they're still very much alive. And would it be possible to actually meet them? So we did, today seems pretty outrageous. We would actually send a letter with a self-addressed stamped envelope to the home addresses of people like Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly.
Well, how did you find the home addresses?
Well, back then there were actually source books that told you that Gene Kelly was at 725 North Rodeo Drive and Fred Astaire was on San Ysidro Drive. And you know how you got stars, homes, maps, and different things like that? So you could get access to their home addresses. So we'd put the postage on, the self-addressed stamped envelope, and lo and behold, they would respond. Now, they wouldn't always respond in the affirmative, but they would respond. And in the case of Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly, in the summer or just before the summer of 1978, they green-lighted visits to Los Angeles. So here we were, literally June of 1978. So 40 years ago, almost to this date, we made this first sojourn via St. Paul to Los Angeles to interview the screen legends Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly.
And you couldn't have started with two better people.
Exactly. Or more revered.
Or more revered.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And because they were so revered, and having that photo taken with Fred Astaire, it opened so many doors for us. And over 200 interviews followed, and about 60 of them happened between 78 and 83 when we were college journalists for the Minnesota Daily, which was a large daily newspaper at the University of Minnesota. And don't forget, and you know, Bonnie, 35, 40 years ago, stars from the golden era were 35, 40 years closer than they are today. So it was not unheard of for us as college students to have film societies and to appreciate the golden age of Hollywood. It's a bigger leap today with younger audiences, and I certainly can vouch for that. I'm teaching some film classes at Marquette, that it is really an education to get them to see some of the classics today.
Well, and a slight digression, some of the classics, I think of Busby Berkeley and, and the kinds of film techniques that were developed. I mean, they were revolutionary at the time, and in some ways they still are. So there's a lot to learn. It's not just enjoyment to go back. If you're actually a film scholar or you're studying it, there's a lot to see and a lot to learn.
Exactly. And, you know, it's really incumbent upon young people, if they're interested in that field, to know its history. And you'd be astonished to know that they don't know Charlie Chaplin or they don't know John Ford. And you're exactly right. The work of these artists, paved the way. I mean, who idolizes John Ford more than a Steven Spielberg? So it's very important to know. And in our book, Rod Steiger told the story. Here he is, won an Academy Award for In the Heat of the Night, playing this sort of racist Southern sheriff. And he was reinventing himself toward the end of his life in the mid-90s. He found himself talking to these young studio executives that maybe had a business MBA from an Ivy League school. And the question they would ask Rod Steiger is, can you do a Southern accent? No clue about the industry's history.
Well, and even though you didn't set out to write an industry history, in a way you have. And, looking at all of the different folks you got to talk to, anyone who loves movies would be sitting there going, oh, I wish I could have been in the room. Was there ever anyone who disappointed you?
No. No one disappointed us because I think they were groomed on the studio system, so they were always very media and fan-friendly when it became to accessibility. I think when Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly opened the door, and our book, Hollywood Heyday, is simply dedicated to Fred and Gene, because we wouldn't be talking about this subject, I wouldn't be at Marquette and what have you, if it wasn't for those first two meetings with Astaire and Kelly. The genius of Fred Astaire is the fact that he was so unaware of his genius. He had no interest in dissecting or really talking about things that he did 20, 30, 40, 50 years earlier. And was there a greater artist, a greater genius in the field of dance than Fred Astaire? But he was totally unaware of it.
Well, and what was interesting in that particular interview, he did talk about how they did that dancing on the ceiling scene, but he was more talking about not what he did, but what all the tech people had to do, and the cameramen had to do.
And that's the famous scene from Royal Wedding where the room moved with the camera, and one of the last survivors of that golden age is the director of that sequence, Stanley Donen, who about 30 years after he did the sequence with Astaire, did Dancing on the Ceiling with Lionel Richie. The exact same technique, not using computers, not using high tech, just did the same thing that they did in 1952 in Royal Wedding.
One of the ones I found most interesting was your conversation with Lucille Ball. Mm-hmm. You talk about finding her very, not prickly, but direct. Mm-hmm. And did that surprise you when you arrived at her house?
Well, sometimes you went to the funny people thinking that they would be on and they would be funny. And it was certainly true with people like Milton Berle and George Burns, or Mel Brooks for that matter. But in the case of two iconic comedic stars, and that's Lucille Ball and Bob Hope, they were probably two of the least funny people you'd ever meet. The reason I think Lucille Ball was not particularly funny is she really broke the glass ceiling for women in the entertainment industry. And people forget that she started Desilu Productions with her husband at the time, Desi Arnaz. She was more of a businesswoman in a male-dominated environment beyond just performing in I Love Lucy. And when we asked her about ad-libbing and slapstick and all the craziness, she said, first of all, I want to make it clear, there were very few episodes in which we did the shtick and the slapstick, even though we remember that. And she said, as it pertains to the script and the stories, the writers knew our characters intimately. There was no ad-libbing. And by 1968, she sold Desilu Productions to the parent company of Paramount Pictures for, at that time, the princely sum of $18 million. So she was extremely savvy, extremely smart in a male-dominated environment, and not particularly funny. And I think the transition to Bob Hope, definitely one of the great comedic icons and entertainment icons of the 20th century, but he was known to be incredibly media accessible, but to really say nothing. We had him for a long interview late at night when he was in the Twin Cities, and he was shockingly frank with us about films he liked, films he didn't like, and it was shortly after Reagan was shot, and he, as a well-known conservative, came out as a strong advocate for gun control. And those are the subject matters he actually talked about in our interview, which is certainly not characteristic of the Bob Hope that was interviewed by many other media outlets.
Right, the Vanity Fair type of things, or a Hollywood Reporter, or one of those.
You'd ask him a question and he would be oblivious to the question and promote the show. That was typically what Bob Hope did.
Why do you think people were so honest with you and so open? Not just accessibility, but to actually get those kinds of interviews.
Well, I think in some respects we had youth on our side, especially for that first round of interviews while we were college students. The other thing that we did, Bonnie, is that because of sort of the golden age of Hollywood, we actually bought our first suits in the Twin Cities. And so there wasn't an interview that we didn't go to back in those days where we didn't afford these people the respect of coming with a suit and tie on. And I think the fact that we were young and had an inordinate amount of knowledge on their careers helped in comparison to maybe some young journalists today who might be interviewing a celebrity like, let's say, Jerry Lewis or something a year or two ago, who would really have no sense of their history or really what to ask. Robert Wagner, who wrote our foreword, was a perfect example. That came about just a couple years ago when we got to RJ, what he lets us call him. The publicist said, you know, you have 30 minutes. She would check in 30 minutes and go, we're having a great time, go away. Over 2 hours elapsed. And it not only was such a rich interview that's in the book, but he said, can I write the foreword? So I think the fact that he was probably used to people interviewing about playing in Austin Powers and things like that, that for someone to go back and talk to him about working with John Ford in What Price Glory, he was pleasantly surprised.
I think in some ways, my sense of it, having read the book now, is that you disarmed them. And it's true with interviews today. Most people don't get below the surface. Mm-hmm. They want, you know, they say, tell me about your book, as opposed to having read your book.
Yeah, and I remember when we first met Gene Kelly in 78, and then we had a second interview at his home the second time, probably 15 years later. And the first thing he said, and here we were, what, 35 to 40 years old, the first thing he said is, the college boys are back. So it's like 15 years had not elapsed.
Is there one that got away that you are sorry that you didn't get into the book?
Well, I have a fun note because it shows the accessibility of these stars of the Golden Age. A handwritten note from Henry Fonda that said, I'm sorry I won't be in L.A. when you're here. I'll be in New Hampshire making a movie. And, of course, it was on Golden Pond when he won an Academy Award, finally. And so I think it shows a little bit to the class and personality. But, I mean, certainly, you know, the fact that we couldn't get to Johnny Carson, that we couldn't get to a John Wayne, that you couldn't get to a Katharine Hepburn, or an Orson Welles. There were certainly stars of great artists that we didn't get to, but when we look back at the 200 plus and the 75 that are in the book, we're pretty pleased by who we did manage to meet.
I know this is Hollywood heyday and golden age, but have you thought about doing this now? Are there people who interest you now that you'd want to talk to?
Well, there are certainly people of that ilk that are in the golden age of now, like a De Niro, a Pacino, a Dustin Hoffman,
a Streep.
But the reality is, Bonnie, it's a different day. Their accessibility is still, because of the handlers, because of the entourage that shields them, you can't go into them and get the kind of access that we had, you know, going back 30 and 40 years. And it's a shame. And so to say we've retired from interviewing individual celebrities is pretty much an accurate description because, again, we really have no much more interest because, and you know, working with celebrities and publicists, the publicists of today, I'm sad to say, having worked in public relations for decades, they've taken the fun out of it. And I don't want to work with these young publicists anymore. They're just very difficult.
So this is
This is the final wrapping.
I was going to say, this is the final wrap, and that's your golden age.
It's our golden age, and it is a wrap. And we understand that it is a niche audience. But I am pleased to do a lot of speaking to, you know, at senior facilities. So those are people who actually lived this. I went to a retirement facility, and a woman came up to me and said, I was Charlton Heston's teacher at New Trier High School in Wilmalee, Illinois. Now, of course, she was in her late 90s, but it was incredibly lucid, and it was great that she came up to me. But then the other side of the scale is I have an opportunity to equate young college students at Marquette with some of these Golden Age classics. And surprisingly, some of them actually come up to me and compare notes with their grandparents and said, I saw Casablanca last night. Or my grandpa knew Bing Crosby from Spokane, Washington. So it's very fulfilling to have that kind of feedback, even from the younger people.
So it goes on. Even though this is a wrap, it continues.
It goes on.
Dave Fantle is the director of marketing for the United Performing Arts Fund. His passion is the golden age of Hollywood, and his new book is called Hollywood Heyday, 75 Candid Interviews with Golden Age Legends. He spoke with Bonnie North.
One more break, and then how art meets utility at both a Wisconsin company and a Wisconsin museum. We gear up for that interview when Lake Effect continues right after this on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Europe is the center of the sports world for a few weeks. Even as the World Cup reaches its zenith in Russia, the Tour de France gets underway on Saturday, the biggest 3 weeks on the world cycling calendar.
Here at home, some Tour de France bikes and others designed by Trek Bicycles at its headquarters in Waterloo, Wisconsin, are on display right now. For more than 40 years, the company has placed itself on the cutting edge of both bike technology and design. Both those attributes are part of the exhibit at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend.
Joyride, designing Trek, features an extensive range of bikes, from Alberto Contador's Tour de France winning road bike to the fat tire bike that Cedarburg native Eric Larson rode to the South Pole, to outrageously fancy bikes conceived and built by Trek designers and artists.
I had a chance to visit the exhibit not long ago and sit down with collections and exhibits curator Graham Reed, along with four members of the Trek bicycle team, Steve Bauman, Ben Fullerton, Kurt Hegland, and Eric Maves. Graham Reed starts by explaining what bikes are doing in an art museum.
One of the things, and this is the second time we've done this, is last year we did the Florence Eisman children's clothing. So what we're doing is we're looking at some of the most creative companies that are that were started here in Wisconsin, that are based here in Wisconsin, but whose products actually reach global audiences. And for children's clothing or for bicycles, it's aesthetics are a huge part of their business. And so bicycles can be very utilitarian, but they can also be beautifully utilitarian. Nobody wants to ride an ugly bike. And I think we've shown that with the exhibition. We've got a mixture of production models, but we've also got the art bikes, which were created by Trek staff, really for themselves, kind of pushing the limits of their creativity and design.
Can you talk about this exhibit from a display challenge? Because you have the bikes residing in among art and form, from furniture to oil painting.
Well, I think when people come into a museum, they kind of have an expectation of what they're going to see, and they are assuming that there are certain artistic, aesthetic color choices of color, pattern, subject matter, and then all of a sudden to put a bicycle next to it. And as we were walking through the galleries, you could see that we took quite a bit of time and effort to try and find the right bike next to the right paintings or the right pieces of sculpture. And I think they kind of speak to each other, or they resonate with each other.
I know you have an existing interest in the bicycle in its utilitarian sense, but what is your interest in bicycles as art itself?
Well, I think they can be. They are art. I mean, we were talking about the fundamental design of a bicycle really hasn't changed much in over 100 years, but certainly the materials that are used, the technology that's involved not only in the production of the bike, but also in the mechanicals of the bike. They're just constantly evolving. I mean, if you come to the exhibition, you can see one of the first Trek bikes from 1976, and then 6 feet away, we've got a bike from basically 40 years later. And to use I don't know if this is a great analogy, but a car analogy, the 1976 bike is like a Model T, and then the 2018 bike is like a Cadillac Ferrari.
Well, and I want to bring some of you gentlemen from Trek in on this question here. At what point does Trek begin to recognize the possibilities of the bicycle as kind of a canvas?
When people walk into a bicycle shop, they want to begin an experience beyond just purchasing something and even riding something. They want to connect emotionally. And so that experience becomes our canvas, and it extends from the bicycle to all the other accessories that people are interested in and the shop itself. We really try to create a continuous feel across all those touch points.
Is it like the idea of the bicycle as an extension of the rider?
It's an extension of the rider and the environment. And of values, actually. When people look at a piece of art or a well-designed product, they want to identify with it at a pretty personal level.
Well, and I had a question for you, because you're essentially the historical curator to this. Walk me through how that became what you do, what, you know, your connection to the bicycle as art.
I guess my entire life I've kind of looked upon bikes as being art or opportunity for art. I've never owned a truly like custom bike or stock bike. Even my very earliest bike, it was just a old department store bike hand-me-down from a relative that my father and I completely customized. And yeah, that's where it started for me. And it's obviously advanced and throughout the years. It's to me, bikes are art. It's functional art. And it's meant to be personal, should be personal. It's great that there's kind of a movement of late where more and more of the buying public, they're looking for something personalized. So we have options within the brand line that make it easy for that to happen.
Well, and the question that occurred to me as I was looking at many of these bikes is this a little like fashion that, you know, you look at the fashion pages of the New York Times and, you know, some of the really flashy clothes aren't necessarily meant for most people to be able to go out and buy, but they inspire the next round of design that connects more with maybe closer to average people.
We are on the fashion spectrum, for sure. We're not the runways of New York or Paris, but we're also not the aisleways of a department store. We do recognize internally that we are in the fashion business. We keep track of what is happening on the runways. We keep track of the colors and the materials and the patterns and really the values and the theories that emerge from those places. And eventually, after enough time passes, they do appear in the sporting world, and that's where we take advantage of it.
Right. I wonder, there are a couple of Alberto Contador's bikes here. There is Fabian Cancellara's bike. There are a number of bikes that have been ridden by high-level pros across cycling disciplines. How much of what they do on their bike, how much attention do you think the average person is paying to the bike itself? How important is what Alberto Contador's bike looks like to what you do?
There's a segment of our audience, our rider base, that pays intense attention to what the pros are doing. You can see it any Saturday morning or Sunday morning when that group of replica riders goes past your house at 25 miles an hour. That experience of being a pro or looking like a pro or getting to use the exact same equipment that a pro gets to use is a really fun experience, and it's pursued by a lot of people, and we love those riders.
Yeah. The thing that can be different than, let's say, in the Formula One industry, where you might idolize it and watch it on the race and you might buy equipment that's inspired by that, but riders can go out if they want to spend the money on it and buy the exact same bike, the same gear, ride it in the same way that the pros are.
Yeah, kind of playing off the same thing with motorsports and Formula One. There's the old reference, win on Sunday, sell on Monday. The same thing can happen for us as well, especially for those true cycling fanatics, the guys that really get behind a particular team or rider. If a product is available that they're riding, you know, they're going to want it.
Well, so from a practical standpoint, what are the complexities in being able to use the bicycle as your canvas? What does it take to be able to actually, you know, take a design that, you know, we talk about the triangles that every bicycle frame or practically every bicycle frame has and do something with it that maybe no one has ever done?
Well, it's a pretty complex symphony of steps and processes where, you know, a concept can come up from one of our senior designers and then it gets the green light to go into production, and then it's a matter of the support staff and the graphics team to emulate that design across a full size range and across potentially multiple platforms of bikes as well. So there's a lot involved to make it come to light and come to market.
Yeah, it's definitely it's a functional sculpture. It's not necessarily like a car or a toaster where there's function on the inside and then crafted over that. Every tube shape has a function to it. Every bolt and screw has a function to it. And we have an amazing engineering counterparts that we're working with all the time to create the best riding bike, and they have to be functional tools. And the difference between, and it can be 2 degrees of difference that makes all the change in how the bike functions, and it's constantly making that and then testing it. And there could be something that you really want to do from an artistic standpoint, but if it hurts the ride, you have to find that compromise on something that actually functions and looks amazing.
And then on top of that functional sculpture, we manage very carefully the colors and the graphics. It's not a sky's the limit opportunity. We've got some paint schemes that are intentionally applied to weigh as little as 15, 25, 30 grams. It's really common for a paint scheme to have a weight limit applied to it. And then certainly because it is a business, we've got cost limits and quality expectations as well. So that's where the artistry really has to partner tightly with business and technology to make sure that the outcome works at every level.
Looking at this exhibit, I gather with only a few exceptions, and maybe no exceptions, all of the bikes that are on display are both road ready and are ridden.
Yeah. Yeah, there's bikes that
there's
have
mud
been
on them.
Yeah, there's mud on them.
Quite a few of them, actually.
Yeah. They've been ran up. One of the bikes, I believe it was one that won the X Games or close to, by some of our professional riders and our professional road riders. Some of them are the personal bikes of the artists that they ride back and forth from work around the city, and they just happen to now be having their break in the art museum. But they're all fully functional. You could ride them right out of the museum.
Yep. You ask that people don't do that, though.
I think that's why they put no pedals on most of them.
The dirt and the grime actually becomes part of the personality of
the
bike.
One of these is your bike.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think, for instance, my bike would have looked as good if I hadn't put that mud on it, you know, and I rode it to get the mud on it on a road that you know, the person I designed it for would actually be driving or riding on. It just adds more to the character, and like Trek has lots of bikes like that were raced in significant races by significant riders, and they still have mud caked on them, and somebody would get in a lot of trouble if they hosed them off, you know.
Which has happened before, yeah. Unfortunately. So,
did it take any convincing to take these bikes out of commission for the 3 months that they are out of commission?
Yes. Or they're... I think a lot of people are missing their bikes right now.
Yeah, for
but
sure. The
artist bikes.
The personal bikes.
Yeah, a lot of people really... I mean, they became such a personal thing to these people, and so much work went into them. But they're happy that they're getting this attention, for sure. But I know I'm one that's missing the ride, for sure.
And on the flip side, the historical bikes, I'm happy that they're being shown. Because... most of the time, they're sadly just tucked away in storage boxes in a warehouse, and they never get to see the light of day. So it's great to have the opportunity to show some of them.
Is that the case with, like, the Contador bikes and the Cancellara bike?
Those were all in boxes up until a little over 2 weeks ago. Yeah.
Even for people who have their eye on design, function, and art, as you do, are there things that you have seen accomplished with the bikes that are here that amaze you?
Certainly. There's things that you can't really appreciate unless you ride them. And unless you've ridden a 15-pound bike, you know, you can't really describe the experience. At an artistic level, one of the bikes in particular by Christina Bybee is just amazing.
This is the one with the gold plating, right?
Yeah, this is the one where she floated ink on top of alcohol and somehow managed to stick it onto a bike frame. It needs to be witnessed to be appreciated, and she accented it with gold-plated componentry, which takes it certainly to the next level. That one we wouldn't have imagined.
Now, has she ridden that bike?
I think she
did a brief christening ride.
I think a lot of the bikes in here look great with mud on them. That's one of the few I think that needs to be pristinely polished dusted all the time. It just looks great.
Well, so of all the various parts of a bicycle, what is the hardest to use in an artistic way?
I think wheels.
Lubrication. Wheels can be...
And you have spokes that, you know...
I was going to ask about spokes.
To do anything with them, you kind of have to disassemble them, you know, because the spokes are a nightmare to work around.
The shifting components, the braking components of a bike are all out in the open, so you've got to pay great attention to them while their function is really clear. I mean, those brake calipers, like Ben was saying earlier, don't have a pretty housing around them. They are what they are. Same thing for a chain or the cassette or the derailleurs. So because those elements are so functional and there are so many parts in such a small space, it's really hard to exercise a lot of artistic direction around those components.
Do e-bikes give you a kind of a whole new opportunity? They do look a little...
Opportunity is a good way to say a challenge. It brings up some challenges with the new complexity to it. Electric motors and batteries, the size of it, all of a sudden the size of the tubes are getting a lot bigger.
It's more surface area to treat.
Yeah, the rider has to interface with this a lot differently. But the amazing part about it is how many new riders it brings in and allows people to ride so much more. And as you saw with our 10, 11 pound bikes, weight is always paramount to it, but weight is still an issue with e-bikes, but it's less of an issue now. So all of a sudden, some of those things and conveniences and features that you might have just scrapped before because of weight or because of complexity or because of the need for a battery to be charged are all of a sudden out the window now. So
mountain bikes were 30 years ago. E-bikes are eventually going to turn into a wave in the United States when cost is controlled and when weight is controlled and quality is where everybody expects it to be. There won't be a reason for people to say no to e-bikes. They just make the ride that much more fun.
I feel like that's a subject for an entirely other interview.
That's a great idea.
Well, listen, it's a fantastic exhibit. I'm thrilled to have gotten a chance to see it. And gentlemen, thank you all so much.
Thank you very much, Mitchell.
We spoke with Graham Reed of the Museum of Wisconsin Art, along with four members of the Trek Bicycle team, product design director Steve Bauman, senior industrial designers Ben Fullerton and Kurt Hegland, and Project One specialist and historical collection curator Eric Maves.
Joy Ride Designing Trek is on display at the Museum of Wisconsin Art until August. You will find a link to photos and much more at WUWM.com. That's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.